There was a letter in the Lansing State Journal a couple of days ago. I'm going to read it to you in its entirety. It was from somebody called Matthew Taylor in Lansing. Maybe some of you know him. More than ever before, Michigan needs marijuana. Why? Just bear with me here, okay? Bear with me. Don't start wondering if I've gone off my head or anything here. More than ever before, Michigan needs marijuana. Why? It's the economy, stupid. Allowing citizens to grow 12 plants in their homes would allow any homeowner to produce $30,000 to $60,000 a year via their ingenuity and private property. Our real estate would be valuable again. Millions of dollars per year of income tax would be produced. Michigan would also make millions from quality tests and registration fees from growers. Even more millions would be made from the lucrative sale of state distribution licenses. Far more millions would be saved by ending the unjust investigation, prosecution, conviction, and imprisonment of nonviolent offenders. Then there are the tourism dollars to consider. Marijuana can be regulated and zoned safely. Michigan needs the potentially billions of dollars per year that would enrich both the state's economy and the citizens. Decriminalization of marijuana would create a sorely needed cottage industry and an economic boom. Now, I think most of us can see through something like this, okay? And we can laugh at it. And I don't know whether the guy meant it to be taken seriously or not. I mean, I would assume not, because he put his name on it, or maybe he put the name of an ex-friend on it. Who knows? I think we can see the thinking behind that, and it's clear to us. But sometimes trends in society, trends in the nation in which we live, are not as clear to us, and we may not be quite as perceptive and seeing how dangerous these trends are. And I want to look today at three dangerous trends in our society which are affecting people in this room to one degree or another. First of all, another article, this time from the Lansing State Journal on New Year's Day, the 1st of January. MSU study examines fallout from friendly sex. This was the front page news story in the Lansing State Journal on Tuesday. And I just want to read you a couple of things from this particular article. This is a trend. It's become extremely popular. Over 60%, I think it says, of people admit to being involved in this particular activity. As relationships that involve sex go, it's supposed to be one of the simpler ones, offering intimacy without commitment, fun without the risks of romance, and all in the close company of someone you trust. But so-called friends with benefits, that's the phrase that's used, so-called friends with benefits relationships, essentially friendships broadened to include physical intimacy, have their own complications and complexities, according to a study by researchers at MSU. That's been Jenny Carson's experience. The 22-year-old student at LCC has had a few friends with benefits relationships. You know, it blows my mind that people would actually have their name in an article and admit to this. But, you know, here's a 22-year-old. I wonder how her parents feel after reading this in the paper. The 22-year-old student at LCC has had a few friends with benefits relationships. In some cases, she wanted them to be something more. In others, she found herself fending off a partner's push for commitment. She's sworn off such relationships now, saying they've just never really been healthy. Everyone is always on different levels, she said. So someone's going to like someone more. There's going to be jealousy. In the end, someone always gets hurt. Reminds me of a scripture. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18. Now, you can turn there, and while you turn there, just ponder this thought that this is very common amongst young people today, and perhaps even older people too, I don't know. But it is a trend in our society. And the article mentioned that 60% surveyed said they've had a friend with benefits. 60% of the people surveyed. Not just MSU students. MSU did the survey, did the research. It doesn't mean they only asked their own students. But 60% admit to having friends with benefits. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18. Flee sexual immorality, or flee fornication, it says in the original King James. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. As Jenny Carlson said in this article, after having had a number of these relationships herself, in the end, someone always gets hurt. You know, people don't know what they're playing with, really. It's dangerous. And emotions are involved. And when a physical relationship comes to an end, comes to an abrupt halt, and there's no prospect of anything any further, then, of course, people get hurt. Sometimes people even commit suicide over it. I've known a number in the church over the years who have. People brought up in the church who killed themselves because of the end of a relationship. In every case I've known, it's always been a guy. And most people think guys are not so sensitive, you know, when it comes to feelings. But, you know, maybe the problem is they internalize them more and just can't handle it and have nobody to talk to. But, you know, God knew what he was doing when he gave us his law. And when he told us, you know, that, one of the Ten Commandments, the seventh commandment is, you shall not commit adultery, and fornication is just... on the same level, really, in the sense that it does the same harm to people. He who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. You know, when you read something like this and realize that 60% surveyed said they've had a friend with benefits, I think of what Fred said in the opening prayer about getting the government that we deserve. Because, you know, this is a very immoral nation now. Now, we're not the only ones who are immoral, and you know, one of the questions that I've got for Jesus Christ at the first Bible study in the sky is, you know, why it is that when the Europeans are even more immoral, they're going to be used to bring us down. It seems unfair. But I think the fact is, you know, we are Israel. Let my name be named on them, Ephraim and Manasseh. And God expected more from us. And we were, until fairly recently, what you might call people of the book being the Bible. That was the foundation upon which our modern civilization was based. Not perfectly, it was imperfect. Be the first to admit to that. But, you know, we did try to make the laws of the land the laws of God. And not just in the United States, but in Britain and other countries as well. But of course, since the 1960s, we've turned progressively away from that. And today, most people don't even know what the Bible says. And, you know, a lot of people, a lot of parents even, would be in favor of friends with benefits. Because they would think, well, at least if it's a friend, the person's not going to have any diseases and is not going to be dangerous or anything. So friends with benefits would actually appeal to the liberal mindset that emanates from the 1960s when, you know, we went through what's known as the sexual revolution. Parents contribute to this by encouraging their offspring to experiment so that they can compare before they marry. Why do we think this is a good idea? Our ancestors did everything they could to keep children pure until marriage. Have we discovered something new about the makeup of children that allows us to throw out all the rules? You know, no, we haven't. The rules, the Ten Commandments, were given for our benefit, and we should be teaching them to our children. The BBC had a report a few days ago on a new museum that has been opened in France, in Paris, devoted to love. Love in quotes. It had to be in France, didn't it, that this was opened. But one of the proprietors of the museum who was interviewed on BBC World Service said, French history is full of examples of infidelity and adultery. And this museum is dedicated to actually, you know, showing all this every manifestation imaginable. I'm not recommending you go there, by the way. If I go to Paris, I certainly will not be going. But, you know, incidentally, the opening coincided with President Sarkozy, the president of France, going to Rome last week to see the Pope. And, you know, if you know the president of France, his wife left him about a month after he took office. And since then, he's had another lady in his life who's she's a former girlfriend of Mick Jagger and, I don't know, somebody else. Even the French prime minister had her as a girlfriend, and now she's the girlfriend of the president of France, so she's gone up in the world. Anyway, you know, President Sarkozy, when he's visiting the Pope, back home in the newspapers, he's accused by the French press of trying to stage desperate housewives in the Elysee Palace in France. That's the French White House. But what is interesting is no attention was given either over there or over here to what Sarkozy did when he was in Rome. I'm just digressing a little bit here. But here is the president of France involved in this scandal, which has hit the newspapers all across Europe and is really quite a big thing. And, you know, when he went into the Pope representing France, which is officially a secular country, it is not a religious country, the church has no role in the French government, unlike some countries in Europe. And he goes to the Pope and he says, France is a daughter of Rome. And he asked the Pope to bring about the unification of Europe. This was last week. And, you know, you wonder if perhaps his private life, he feels so guilty about some things that maybe he's trying to divert some attention. And, you know, he brought this out with the Pope and trying to get right with the Pope. But anyway, it just shows immorality is all over the place and even at the highest levels. And I think we all understand that. But doesn't make it right. And friends with benefits is a new trend, which, of course, is very wrong. Then there's a second trend that I want to highlight here. And again, I see it more and more, particularly with younger people, but not exclusively by any means. And that is people acting out their own personal soap opera or other TV show. Again, the Lansing State Journal article writing about this Friends with Benefits said the MSU study was the first to explore how these relationships play out. Bisson, who was the major person involved in the survey, Bisson got the idea after watching an episode of Seinfeld in which Jerry and Elaine discuss adding sex to their friendship. And Bisson soon discovered researchers hadn't much explored the phenomenon. You see how television spreads these trends. And here was something that came out in the comedy series Seinfeld. And, you know, I think all of us in this room have probably seen at least some episodes of that. But, you know, again, we don't realize just sometimes how influential some of these programs can be. I mean, even the Italian and French press is saying that President Sarkozy is, you know, watching, he's trying to act out Desperate Housewives, a TV show in the Elysee Palace. See how influential the media is and how it contributes to a great deal of this immorality. People's lives seem increasingly dramatic. At the same time, there's an increasing inability to commit to any long-term relationships. These are, you know, trends that I've seen in my own pastorate in helping people, not just in Lansing, but in other areas as well, and, of course, through Breaking Free, the new online website that we've got. You know, this is a problem that, you know, often people live lives which just reflect some of the soap operas on TV or the dramas on television. They've seen them on television, and so they're acting them out all the time. They don't realize that they're doing it, but that's what they're doing. So it's quite normal for people, couples, whether married or not married, to have constant arguments and, you know, break off the relationship, and then they're back together again, and then another week goes by and they break off the relationship again. And I get some of the calls, you know, from people when they go through these kind of things. And they're in an addictive cycle, which, you know, you could call the Jerry Springer cycle, I guess, is what they should call it. I don't know if there is a name for it. But it's just interesting that, you know, it wasn't like this. It certainly hasn't been like that for my wife and myself, you know, but I think in a lot of relationships, arguments and verbal abuse, certainly, and sometimes even the occasional physical abuse, are very much components of the relationship. And, you know, you wonder why some people stay in these relationships when there's physical abuse, not just by the man against the woman, sometimes by the woman against the man. I had a case in England like that, where a young lady in the church, you know, married a guy, and you know, when he came home from work, regularly she would just go for the jugular, literally with a knife sometimes. And you know, it was all due to things in her background that were coming out in the marriage. But you know, he was caught up in this marriage, and you know, what do you do? It was not just a simple case of walk away, because there were children involved, and you know, he was concerned about the children being left with the mother. You know, it was all kinds of complications there. But, you know, you were seeing more and more of this kind of thing. This may explain the current popularity of Jane Austen. She recently made the top 10 on the New York Times bestseller list. Quite something for a lady who lived 200 years ago. But why the appeal? Again, there was another study, and I never kept the newspaper article, so I couldn't bring it. There was another study in that I read about some time ago, where one university had all the students reading Jane Austen's books that were written in the early part of the 1800s, and they're all love stories, but they're not like, you know, the typical romantic novel. I mean, they're classics of the English language. They very much recreate the way that things were at that time, certainly amongst the wealthier people, and they go into relationships a great deal. And you learn a great deal from the books when you read the books. And she's so popular right now that PBS's Masterpiece Theater, starting not tomorrow but the following Sunday, is showing all six of her novels successively over many weeks. But at this particular university where they studied Jane Austen's works, when the professor asked the students, who were all, you know, young people, 18 to 25 or whatever, asked them if they would want to adopt the dating customs from Jane Austen's period, the early 1800s, replacing the present dating customs, friends with benefits, 80% said they would rather go back to the way that people dated in Jane Austen's time. 80%. These were Americans. I've forgotten which university, but 80%. Because, you know, people are getting hurt all the time in the kind of relationships that people have. In the main, not absolutely, because I know there are some good relationships, but I'm talking about, you know, the general trend in society. Relationships are a major problem. We have nothing we can teach the world about relationships because we don't have much success in that area ourselves as a nation, as a people. And you can see why a lot of people would like to go back to relationships as they were in the time of Jane Austen. 80% of college students polled wish they could have the kind of relationships depicted in Austen's works, where society was regulated by strict rules that governed relationships. No touching at all until an engagement, and then only holding hands. You know, that was it. But people learned to love each other and appreciate each other before there was anything physical. So their emotions were not getting hurt all the time. They were not going through this never-ending dramatic cycle that so many people go through today. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. You know, Paul was somebody who had been married. You know, we know that in the epistles he's single. In Acts he's single. But he must have been married because he was a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court. And to be on the Sanhedrin, you had to be at least 30 and married, I think with children too. in order to be on the Sanhedrin. So he must have been married. It is possible that when Paul's dramatic conversion took place, his wife left him. Because if you remember, Saul had been persecuting the church, even authorizing the deaths of people, including Stephen in Acts chapter 8. And then suddenly in Acts chapter 9, when Saul is on the road to Damascus, Jesus Christ appears to him, and the most dramatic conversion recorded in the New Testament takes place. And he's a changed man, totally changed man. And that might have just been too much for his wife. She would, of course, had she stayed with him, have lost all her friends in the Jewish community, the Pharisaic community, and would have been the subject of ridicule. But Paul could not deny that Jesus Christ had appeared to him. And he could not go against his calling. He could not kick against the pricks, as the term is used in Acts chapter 8, using an analogy with oxen. And, Paul, after that, then remained single. And because of the persecution that was taking place, the Apostle Paul wrote here in 1 Corinthians about how it would be better in the present state of distress in which we find ourselves. Look at verse 26. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. It's better for a man to be single because we are going through such awful times. When the church was being persecuted and people were being put to death for their faith, it would be best if a man did not marry and have responsibility for a wife and children. But he begins in verse 1, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." It's interesting, not to touch a woman is referring to not marrying. So the touching and the marriage go together. There wasn't touching before the marriage. And that is generally the custom, even in most cultures today. We checked out an Indian movie a while ago. I've forgotten what it was called, but it was the first musical about terrorism, which in itself is rather perverse. But I remember this one scene where a bomb is sent to his house by the terrorists, and he walks out of the room, and his wife opens the parcel, and she's blown up. And then immediately, the next scene is the two of them dancing together, but under the Bollywood's rules and the Indian government's rules, there cannot be any intimacy. So they cannot kiss on movies at all, and the touching is very limited. I mean, it's okay if it's your clothes rubbing against each other like that, but nothing skin to skin. So it's amazing how they do these elaborate dance routines, and never go over the line. You remember Richard Gere went across the line when he was in India. He kissed a TV hostess, and I think he was arrested, wasn't he, for a while. He was going to be held by the Indian government because, that required a prison sentence. And finally, they let him go, I think, probably decided that he was against reforming, that it was impossible. Anyway, here, the Apostle Paul is writing, "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." So, in other words, to avoid immorality, a couple should get married, is what it's saying here. "Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband." He's writing very tactfully here, talking about physical intimacy. "The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." So Paul knew the feelings that people have, the passions, and how easy it is to be tempted. "But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment." He's not saying that this is ex cathedra coming from God. He's saying this is, my advice to you. But, it's certainly based on what the Old Testament teachings were regarding relationships. "For I wish that all men were even as I myself." Paul seemed to get along fine, without a wife. "But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them to remain even as I am. So, you know, it's okay to stay single as I am, Paul said, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And, you know, good, sound advice here. Now, of course, what's happening in our society today, thanks to birth control, and certainly especially the invention of the birth control pill in 1960, which triggered off the sexual revolution of the 60s, what's happening in our society today is that people burn with passion all the time. In fact, even passion's not needed anymore because it can just be a friend, friends with benefits. You know, no, there's no need for any romantic feeling at all. It's just purely physical. But the end result is, of course, that people often don't get married until they're in their 30s, well past their sell-by date. You know, that's the way it is today. Is anybody about to hit 30? I better be careful what I say here. I don't know. Wasn't thinking about that. But anyway, I saw a cartoon again in the paper a couple of days ago, which I thought was amusing. Some lady goes up to a younger lady and says, "Are you dating?" The other lady, by the way, is past her sell-by date, too. But anyway, you know, the question is, are you dating? And she says, well, there are a lot of single older men out there. So the odds are good. And as she says that, one of these men passes by. Says, so the odds are good, but the goods are odd. My daughter would agree with that. She's 26 and talks about some of the guys that she meets and what they're like at that age group. And I realize none of our guys here are like that at all. But look at Philippians chapter 4. Just turn there for a moment. But, you know, it's very, very sad the way that our culture is today. And it's much more difficult for our young people today in this area. It's this minefield of love and romance. It's much more difficult than it was. You know, 30 or more years ago when, you know, we were dating, or going back even further. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, again, just realize the influence of the media that television and movies have. Because we see this constant soap opera that goes on in some people's lives. The volatility that takes place in relationships. It shouldn't be like that. There shouldn't be constant arguments, throwing things at each other, walking out on each other, and then coming back again afterwards. You know, relationships that are constantly up and down, up and down. It shouldn't be like that. But I think people are influenced so much by what they see in the media. And then, of course, also this constant changing of partners, too, which, again, comes back to TV programs. You know, my wife used to say she used to come over about once a year to the States when we lived in Ghana. And when she stayed with her mom and her grandmother in two separate homes, when she visited them both, I think they both watched soap operas, but your grandmother definitely watched all the soap operas. And she said, the only difference... I said, how do you kind of sit there again after a year? She says, well, the only difference is every year it's the same people, but they've got different partners. So when she'd go back the next year, they'd have a different partner to the previous year. And this, of course, is the standard fare of most of these television programs. To keep the interest up, they've got to switch partners every few months. And that's what happens. And just as when they advertise beer, people go out and buy the beer, maybe not immediately, but they will buy it eventually because that, you know, that ad sticks in your mind and you know the brand and you associate it with whoever the good-looking person is that's promoting it. And then, you know, you go to the store and buy it in the same way you act out the television programs. People don't realize it. Maybe not everybody does. But it certainly has a cumulative effect upon people. So many of us in the ministry find that people are acting out a soap opera or a talk show. In fact, one person was telling me recently about their friends, and I made the comment, I have difficulty understanding some of this. And I said, I clearly need to watch more Jerry Springer. I think I've told the Lansing congregation before, but you know, some of you are not from Lansing, so I'll mention this too. A few years ago, I'd had an accident, and I'd broken my wrist, and I wasn't able to drive for a while. And when I went down to ABC, I had to go on Greyhound, an experience I will never forget. And I won't tell you all the stories, but I'll tell you one story, and that was from Lima in Ohio. The bus stopped, and some young guy got on in his 20s who, you know, was rather disheveled and unshaven. And, you know, we drove along for a little while, and then we passed this police car. And suddenly the guy shouts out the worst expletives imaginable about the police. And, you know, the great cheer goes up around him and around me in the bus. I was near the back of the bus. This great cheer went up. And, you know, then the guy proceeds to tell us his story, that the previous night he had picked up some woman and gone to a motel, and in the middle of their physical relationship, the police kicked down the door, pulled them both out of bed, and then strip-searched them for drugs. And so again, he uses all these expletives against the police. As soon as he finished, another person behind me starts talking about similar experiences with the police. And then another person started talking about similar experiences with the police. And then another, and I thought, what am I going to say when it comes to my turn? You know? I got a parking ticket once in East Lansing, you know? I mean... But it's clear that people live, you know, these dramatic lives. That's the only way you can phrase it. I mean, it's just unbelievable the way that some people live. But, you know, clearly I was in a minority on Greyhound. When I told my son this, Kurt said, well, you know how at the end of Oprah it says official carrier of the Oprah Winfrey Show is United Airlines? He said with Greyhound, the official carrier is the official carrier of the Jerry Springer Show. And I could believe that because I don't watch Jerry Springer. I don't watch Oprah either. But you know, I'm familiar with both of them. So we've got to be careful what we want. Philippians 4 and verse 8 says, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. You know, so we need to be careful about what we let go into our minds. And that will help us then to live more Christian lives, certainly lives more in accordance with the way that we should be living. Look at Ephesians chapter 2. Here's a passage that certainly we can understand more in the light of the way our modern communications are and the media is today. Here in Ephesians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins. And this is true with any of us who are in God's church. He made us alive. He gave us the possibility of eternal life, in other words. Who were dead in trespasses and sins before we lived the way the world lives, which is just full of sin. In which you once walked according to the course of this world. That's the way that most people who God calls did live at one time. According to the prince of the power of the air. Terminology describing Satan, the prince of the power of the air. And I think we can understand it so much more today with television and with movies because, you know, Satan just beams out that signal to try and turn us away from God and God's way of life and to try to get us to break God's commandments. You know, he's put across the idea that the commandments are just a lot of no's. Don't do this, don't do that. But and that they're meant to stop us having fun is the idea that a lot of people have. But of course the commandments are there to tell us how to live happy, peaceful, prosperous, contented, fulfilled lives. That's why he gave us the commandments. These are the things to avoid if you want to live life to the full and you want to be happy and you want to live a long life. But the prince of the power of the air, of course, tries to convince us to the contrary. The spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, the spirit who definitely works on Greyhound, and I'm sure works on other transportation facilities as well. This is the way people live, among whom we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. You know, the Romans and the Greeks, Ephesus was a Greek-speaking community. It had been a part of Alexander the Great's empire, and it was still a part of the Hellenistic world. And, of course, the Hellenistic world had been taken over by Rome by the time that the Apostle Paul was the apostle. Rome and Greece were unbelievably depraved. I mean, the ancient world may have given us some good things, but it was depraved in terms of its morality. And, a major reason for that was because they didn't have any understanding of the true God. They had their own pagan gods, and their own pagan gods, according to their mythology, had all kinds of relationships with each other. But in Rome and Greece, everything was acceptable, and I mean everything, and in public too. Not just in private, but in public. It was just unbelievable depravity. And this was what Paul was up against. But, you know, it's becoming that way in our own society. We might think, well, certain things are not acceptable in public, but in a sense they are, because people do things in public and then other people rent the videos that are made from that. So in a sense, it's in public. And does that make us any better than Rome or Greece? I don't think so. You know, again, we produce 80% of the world's pornography here in the United States. So I think we can understand what the Apostle Paul was writing about and what his concerns were. It's not just the movies or TV shows. It's also the fact that they can be so addictive, which brings me to the third dangerous trend in our society: addictions at the expense of relationships. TV is no longer the number one electronic addiction. We can now add the internet, whether it be chat rooms or adult websites. There's also video games. Even cell phones are addictive. I've been in restaurants and homes where parents, usually the father in this context, ignores the children because of his addiction. And you see this more and more. I've come to a deeper understanding and appreciation of the last couple of verses of the book of Malachi over this. Malachi chapter 4, this is the last two verses of the Old Testament, and it's a prophecy which I don't think has been fulfilled yet, or if it has, only been fulfilled partially. So we still have some time to go in this. But it's interesting, we need to ask the question, rather than speculating on exactly what it means prophetically and how it's going to be fulfilled, let's instead ask why it is that Malachi wrote these words. He says in verse 5, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." Now, why did he have to write this? I'm sure it applied at the time that he wrote it, but it also applies to our time today. And our time today is the time that is immediately prior to that, the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So there certainly is a prophetic meaning here as well. But why does it say this? Surely it's only natural for a father to have his heart turned towards his children. Well, actually, no, it isn't. You know, I've had a few young ladies in their 20s tell me in frustration that, you know, the guys they meet, any prospective mate has already got at least one child, maybe two or three, from previous relationships. If they're football players, they might have nine. You know, and they're supporting all of these kids. You know, the money's being taken out of their pay, child support's being taken out, deducted immediately each week before they even get the balance. So $300-$400 or even more dollars are being sent on a regular basis to pay for children from previous relationships. But whenever young ladies express this frustration, one thought that I often have is, well, wait a minute. you're in Michigan or Indiana or Ohio, wherever it is, and he's here because you're dating him here, but the child is in California or Florida or Texas or South Carolina, because come across that, you know, different places. Children are elsewhere. So the father has no interest whatsoever, in many cases, in his child. You know, I find that hard to believe. You know, you'd think a father would naturally have his heart turned towards his children. In previous generations overall, that was the case. Your children were your future social security. That's still the case in many cultures today. But governments have stepped in here, which has altered the balance. Added to which, the fear of divorce makes a lot of men afraid to get too close, or stops them from being able to get close to their children in some cases. I'm talking about young children here. I'm not talking about adult children who have to move to another state for a job, for work. That's a different thing altogether. I mean, I'm over here. My parents were over in England. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about young children here, you know, who need to have two parents, a mother and a father. I heard a comment on Al Jazeera in Ghana. It's on television every day in Ghana for about half an hour or an hour. And, you know, I heard a comment, and I've thought about it so many times. I want to use it in an article at some time, but I think it's a very valid comment. The United States had expressed concern about human rights in some Middle Eastern country. And these people were talking about it, and one lady made the comment. She said, the basic human right of every child is to have two parents, a mother and a father. In the United States, 50% of children don't have two parents. So who are the Americans to lecture us on human rights? And I thought, wow, has she ever got a point? It is a very good point, because it is a basic right that every child has to have both a mom and a dad, and to live with both until he or she becomes an adult and leaves home. But of course today we get a lot of fathers whose hearts are not tuned to the children. But even when mom and dad are together and the children are there and the family lives together in the traditional sense, dad is not always tuned in to the children. Typically today there are no boundaries. People take their work home with them. My son, for example, who's 28 and has two children, has to be on call all the time. If there's a problem at work, his staff will call, which interrupts his family time. You know, that I think that's terrible. It's actually illegal in the European Union. You know, when you finished work, that's it. Your company cannot call you. And when you're on vacation, your company cannot ask you to do anything. So, and I think that's good, because that helps protect and preserve the family time that people have. So anyway, you may not be able to do much about some calls, but of course you can try not to initiate calls and try to be more selective of which calls you take. But tune in to your children, because I've seen increasingly that often people are not. Now, mothers usually are, simply because, I think, first of all, there's a greater attachment there. The mother is the one who carries the child for 9 months and then goes through the difficulties of childbirth. And so there's a natural attachment there in most cases, not in every case by any means, but generally there is. And then, of course, usually when a child is very young, the mother has more time with the child. So, you know, mothers often are much more tuned in. But fathers are often not tuned in. Their hearts are not turned naturally to their children. And sometimes I've seen fathers, you know, playing with their cell phones, sending messages, while the children want some attention and they're not getting it. Or sometimes they're playing video games or watching something on TV. And again, it's all right to do those things in moderation. And certainly if there's, you know, once a week, if you want to watch a football game or something, just ask your children just to let you watch the game. That's fine. But, you know, when sometimes it becomes addictive and it's all the time or most of the time, and then of course children feel neglected, and then of course they act up to try to get attention. And I think we see this more and more. We need to tune in to our children, to give them 100% of our attention whenever we can. Special times with our children to make sure they do appreciate, that we do show that we appreciate them and love them. You know, you think of the spiritual analogy, how would you feel if God didn't listen to you? Well, that's how a child feels when dad or mom is preoccupied. So we do need to tune in much more. And you know what's interesting at the end of this verse? Let me look again at verse 6. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. You know, it is a sad state of affairs we've got when 50% of children don't have, they don't live with their father. 50% don't have both parents. You know, it's a really sad state of affairs when the children do need both parents. And I think in the case of some guys, because there's so many difficulties trying to see their child, emotionally they cut themselves off because they can't handle it either. It's not just the, you know, it's not solely their fault. It's very difficult sometimes, I think, for them. But, you know, there's a responsibility here towards our children. It's interesting, at the end of verse 6, it says, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. You know, without fathers, society is seriously in danger. Children have no sense of identity. They get their identity primarily from their father. In our culture, they even take their name from the father. And so, you know, they don't have the identity that they need to have. You know, one thing that, you know, I've come to understand with Breaking Free, and before that, the work that we did with Anchor, is, you know, people who struggle with problems like same-sex attraction. It goes back to, you know, the role of the father and problems in early life. Most criminal activity does. 90% of our criminals, I read this some years ago, it might have changed, might have dropped to 89% now, but 90% of our criminals had no father. Or they didn't know their father. They didn't live with their father. You know, it even extends to the animal world. A documentary I saw about elephants in a southern African park, in order to cull the numbers of elephants, this park killed off the older male elephants. And then for 2 or 3 years, the younger male elephants were just running around, trampling everything, killing people. And then finally at a meeting, asking, what can we do about this? Somebody said, well, maybe we need some older male elephants. So they brought some in from another reserve, and it solved the problem. You know, but we don't think about doing that in cities like Detroit. You know, we need some older fathers to make the younger people who cause many of the problems, you know, more cooperative and yield more and submit more to the law. Now, marital relationships are also affected by these addictions. All relationships require time if they are to be successful. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 3. These three problems that we've highlighted, these three trends in our society, are covered in this particular passage, which talks about the time in which we live. In verse 1, know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves. And when you think about it, that sums up many of these addictions. Men will be lovers of themselves. And lovers of the gadgets that they've got, the electronic things and the possessions and so on. Lovers of money. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, or lovers of people for that matter. Having a form of godliness, but denying its power. And from such people, turn away. For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts. You know, we do live in an age where there's just no self-control in this particular area. Always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. You know, we're always in darkness. I mean, you look at our society. We've got the problem with cervical cancer, you know, is such a big problem now. So what do? They come out with a vaccination, and they want girls to have this at 11 or 12 so that they're all ready for sexual activity at that age. So our solutions to problems actually only make things worse. They actually encourage greater promiscuity and sin. Always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. You know, so we try to prevent AIDS using prophylactics, which don't actually stop the spread of the HIV virus. You know, so again, another example. We're in the dark. Now, as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapproved concerning the faith. But they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all, as theirs also was. I mean, people are certainly starting to see through it. When 80% of college students would, if given the opportunity, elect to do things Jane Austen's way instead of Hollywood's way. And her books, a few weeks ago anyway, were in the top 10 of the New York bestsellers list. So, you know, a lot of people, I think, are looking at these previous ways in which other generations did things and wondering if there might not be some merit in it. So three dangerous trends: friends with benefits, acting out a soap opera, and electronic addictions. 50, even 25 years ago, these particular problems did not exist. But now they're very real and affect everybody in this room to one degree or another. We need to be aware of them and to make sure that we're not going to let them be a part of our lives. I look forward to seeing you all again. But meanwhile, I'm going to enjoy some sunshine for a couple of weeks. So if you have another snowstorm, I'll be present at least when I watch the news and see you all snowed in. And I'll remember you all.